The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
I am Sadhu, master of the theater of the macabre. Tonight, we begin with torture. Again, I warn you that if you find what you see is a little upsetting to your stomachs, then just pretend we're play acting. For if you are skeptical or bored, then just pretend that what you see is real.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is WDET reporter Rob St. Mary.
Thank you, sir. So kind to be here in the projection booth of the macabre with you, Mr. Mike White. But can you do me a favor and not run with those scissors? Somebody might get hurt.
This week, we're looking at a classic, Joel M. Reed's Bloodsucking Freaks. Originally released under the title The Incredible Torture Show, Bloodsucking Freaks tells the story of an off-Broadway theater run by Sardou, master of the macabre, and his henchman Ralphus. The pair puts on an act of torture and depravity, all in the name of art. Behind the scenes, things aren't quite so wholesome. Released in 1976, Bloodsucking Freaks is a film made in the Herschel Gordon Lewis gore tradition. There's fake blood, eyeballs, and body parts aplenty. It also mixes a myriad of fetishes like fornophilia, impact play, water sports, and more. And in some respects, it's a precursor to today's torture porn films. Rob, before we dive right into the movie, you've got a good story about how you came across the film. I want you to give us a scoop.
Back in 1997, here in the Detroit area, I made a little vampire film called Tainted. And that was back in the pre-digital days, so we shot it for about $30,000 or so on 16mm. And in 1998, in the final days of VHS, if you remember those, if you're old enough to remember when dinosaurs roamed the earth, Troma Entertainment in New York decided that, hey, you know, my little vampire film that we made here in Detroit would be just perfect for them. So they picked it up. And we went to New York to sign the papers for the distribution deal. The folks over at Troma Team Video, which is the video wing of Troma Entertainment, best known, obviously, for The Toxic Avenger, Class of Nukem High, things like that. We're talking about, you get to raid the prize closet here at Troma Team Video. So it's like, whatever movies you want on DVD or on VHS. So, and this was in the early days of DVD. I didn't have a player yet. So I took a whole mess of VHS tapes back to Detroit with me. You know, some of the bigger titles, as I said. And there was all this discussion around Bloodsucking Freaks. And how it was just, it was one of those notorious titles in their library of films. And I'm like, yeah, I'd heard about it, but I'd never seen it. So I was like, yeah, okay, well, you know, put that in the bag and I'll take that with me. And then on the plane ride home from New York, I had received an autographed copy of Lloyd Kaufman's book, his autobiography that he put out in the late 90s called All I Need to Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger. And in there, he talks about the early days of Troma and picking up Bloodsucking Freaks, and he talks about now, and even on the front of the DVD that they put out, that if Joel M. Reed came to him now with, which was then The Incredible Torture Show, and then Troma relabeled Bloodsucking Freaks, he might not put it out. He just said that, you know, this movie has no socially redeeming value, this movie is just, you know, horrible, it's, you know, anti-woman, and it's misogynistic, and it's just, I don't want to...
Because Lloyd Kaufman's always the purveyor of fine taste.
He is the purveyor of fine taste. I mean, you know, so it was just interesting that he wouldn't want to pick it up. So, in matter of fact, it's kind of a hobby of mine to actually collect kind of banned or notorious things, be it books, film, you know. I think that you learn more about the people who want to ban and censor things based on what they don't like more than the actual art itself. Because It's like over time, if you go back and you look at certain things, it's like, really, it wasn't that bad, you know, some of this stuff. And I always think what people get upset about really tells you quite a bit about them. So the first time I watched it, I got to admit, I couldn't get Bloodsucking Freaks out of my head. So I watched it again, and then I even wrote an essay like in the late 90s. I think it was like 99 or 2000, which I remember the title was, it was called Sucking Meaning from Bloodsucking Freaks. I can't find it now, but I basically kind of postulated this theory that Bloodsucking Freaks, with all of its nudity and gratuitous violence against women, is actually a pro-feminist statement.
I went back and, of course, rewatched Bloodsucking Freaks this week. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, I can't believe that I used to watch this in high school all the time. Apparently, well, it was one of many films that we would watch. But it was, I mean, with that box cover art just calling out to us at Blockbuster. And of course, you know, again, Blockbuster, they're out there censoring and pulling basically classics to me, like Suspiria and these kind of films. Bloodsucking Freaks, no problem with that movie. Not at all. No. Absolutely fine.
Last Temptation of Christ was notorious. They pulled that.
Bloodsucking Freaks, no problem whatsoever. But yeah, that was great to see. And it was nice to revisit. You know, I think what appealed to us was the gratuitous violence, the gratuitous nudity, but really the humor that's in the film and the relationship between Sardou and Ralphus.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we talked about, you talked about in the introduction that Bloodsucking Freaks really is maybe the genesis for what we see as torture porn, or what some people call gorno, you know, the gore porn, you know, the Saw films, the Hostel stuff, things like that. But I think that Bloodsucking Freaks has more humor.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely lighter. It's fun at times. Hostel's not.
Well, it's, they leave no stone unturned. I mean, there isn't a moment in Bloodsucking Freaks where there's any kind of normalcy whatsoever. I mean, the scene that comes to mind is Ralphus cooking up dinner, and it can't just be dinner. He's got a whole frying pan full of eyeballs, you know? It's like everything has to be twisted in this film, and that's kind of what I enjoy about it.
It's one of those films for me, it's like I can't watch it all the time. I mean, I watch it every now and then. I mean, like every couple of years, I might pull it out or something like that. And I, to be honest, I don't think I've ever watched it with anyone that I've dated.
It's not really a good date movie.
No, it's, I mean, I have like test films, like Raising Arizona is a test film.
Oh yeah.
Like I'll tell you that if you want to start dating a girl and you show her Raising Arizona and she hates it, run the other way because yeah. But the thing is with this one, it's like, I've been kind of afraid even to show, like, my ex-wife.
Right.
You know, when we were together this, because I was afraid she might run the other way. But if you look at it on a superficial level, if you look at Bloodsucking Freaks on the superficial level, yeah, it's horrible, it's anti-woman, it's all this stuff. But if you look at it on a deeper level, and you look at maybe sort of an art level or a symbolic level, there's a lot more going on there.
Well, even at a surface level, I mean, it's just so outrageous. Sardou is trying to put on this show, and it reminds me a lot of, like, Wizard of Gore, where, you know, you don't know if these tricks are real or if they're not. And, of course, all the tricks are real. All this stuff that he's showing to the audience is 100% real. He is killing people on stage and doing these horrible things, cutting off body parts and you know, screwing these massive headgear into this woman's head and all this kind of stuff. But it's just so silly at the same time, and you've got all of the fake blood effects and just, you know, how ridiculous it is. Sardou is there and he's trying to put on his shows, and he's doing this all in the name of art, really, you know. It's just like he wants to put this on, and he's getting kicks from it, obviously, and he's got this whole cavalcade of women down in the basement, all in this cage, who I don't know if they're necessarily participants in the show at some point, or if they're just going to hang out there the whole time, because they're like...
They guard his money.
They guard his money.
He hides the money under them.
That's
because
right.
They're crazed women.
That's right. And then you've got Ralphus, his henchman, who's played by dwarf Louis de Jesus. The main thrust of the plot is Sardou trying to get this ballerina to dance for him. At the same time, he's got a critic who's really kind of capping on a show.
Mr. Silo, a donation for the actors.
Actors? No true actor would submit to engage in such trash.
But you are going to review my show.
Absolutely not. You heard me in there. If I were to review your so-called show, even badly, I fear some of my readers might come just out of curiosity. And I do not want to be responsible for keeping your theater open one more day.
So Sardu is just incensed. He wants to have people watch the show. He wants to spread his entertainment around, and he comes up with this brilliant idea of this sadistic ballet. I don't know about you, but I'd be first in line for tickets for that one.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, like, the ballerina is supposed to be, she's supposed to be like one of the finest ballerinas in the world. And she's supposed to be at Lincoln Center, which this to me is funny because, like, everything looks like, in terms of design, it looks like it was all shot in the same space.
Oh, yeah.
And it has, like, if anyone has ever been in theater or done theater, it looks like it was all shot in a black box theater. Mm-hmm. So there's no windows. All the walls are black. The bedroom's that way. The police, you know, office is that way. Sardu's hangout is that way. You know, it's like, wow, I didn't know that Lincoln Center was so grungy.
Yeah.
And the thing you were talking about with the critic is that Joel M. Reed names the critic Creasy Silo. Mm-hmm. Now, for us nowadays, we might not remember back in the 70s and in the 60s, there was a great critic for the New York Times named Clive Barnes. Mm-hmm. Silo, Barnes, get it? And he also does theater and dance, which is exactly what Clive Barnes always used to review for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole thing in there. So there's this whole idea that Reed's asking in terms of, like, what's the place of the critic? What is the place of the critic? And I think in a lot of ways, maybe he's writing Sardu's dialogue as his retort back to critics who maybe had torn apart his earlier work, or maybe even he knew we're going to tear apart this work. Because, I mean, Reed had a few kind of minor hits in terms of exploitation film. Probably his most well-known one from title alone is Career Bed in the late 60s. So it's kind of interesting how he uses that. And it's really kind of interesting also this interplay. Like I said, if we take it on the level, which we'll get into a little while later, is that maybe Silo also represents maybe the new wave of thinking in terms of sort of the place of art, or the if Sardu represents sort of the patriarchy, then maybe Silo is sort of like the evolved thought of the modern man in a way, the more educated man, as opposed to this. You know, I'm not to say Sardu isn't educated. He obviously, he is. He has sort of a continental accent. I've kind of put him as sort of like a low-rent Hannibal Lecter, or maybe even sort of a less flamboyant Joker character. Mm-hmm. You know, he has that kind of sadistic attitude and humor and, you know, proper manners and things like that attitude.
Right, because at no point do you hate Sardu, which is interesting to me, because he's doing all these horrible things to people, but he's so much fun to watch while he's doing it.
It's like it is like in a way like Hannibal Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a guy that we root for, but against maybe another part of us that we wouldn't want to.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting too is that if you notice in the film, he never personally tortures anyone.
Right.
So this gets into the whole dynamic with Ralphus in a way, Louis de Jesus' character. Who is he's a dwarf. Not only that, but he's also a person of color. And the only other people who are Sardu's assistants
are also
two black women.
Mm-hmm.
And they do all the torturing. So there's this whole kind of like, is Reed trying to make a statement about, I'm the white man in charge and I send these minions out to do my bidding? Like, one could even say that, and it might be a stretch, but one could even say that maybe that was sort of the cynicism of the time because of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And there was so many black, a disproportionate soldiers, amount of black soldiers that went to the front to do the bidding of the patriarchy, I guess, if you reconsider it at the time, of the white man with the power. And Ralphus talks in that step and fetch it kind of master this, master that.
Mm-hmm.
And
right, you've got the two different levels of master. You've got, well, actually three. You've got the Igor kind of master, you've got the S&M type master, and then you've got the slavery master as well.
Yeah, and I would even go one further because there's a point where Sardu's like hurt at one point,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, Ralphus is tending to him, and there's this whole kind of dynamic, which I remember I used to read a lot of Malcolm X stuff and hear a lot of speeches and things like that. And Malcolm X would talk about the difference between the house and the field slave.
Right.
And the house slave would always be like, oh, we sick? Mm-hmm. You know, we hurt master? You know, right. It's like he would identify with the man in the house while the field slave mm-hmm. was the one that wanted to kill the master.
Right.
So there was this, you know, dichotomy on the plantation. But the thing is that within the world that Reed's created in Bloodsucking Freaks, the Ralphus character is very much sort of, I guess, as Malcolm X would say, sort of the house slave. And even though he knows he's lesser than Sardu the Master. He still derives a certain amount of power, ability to do things, ability to get off what he needs to get off, either in, you know, in a physical sense, you know, he's taken care of. He gets to, you know, torture people from time to time because Sardu gives him the okay to do it. So there's all these dynamics in terms of, is he making a statement on race? Is he making a statement on, well, on the place of feminism at the time to some extent as well?
There's that very telling scene when Sardu is asking Ralphus to go out and kidnap Creasy Silo. And he's like, well, what are you going to do for me, master? I love this part when Sardu takes his keys off of his belt and moves them from one side to another to be like, yo, I'm moving from master to slave role now. And then it becomes this whole, like, S&M scene that goes on from there.
You've been a very bad boy today.
Have I really been that bad? Must I be punished?
You know, when we were talking about Sardu to some extent, too, is that His character, I mean, Seamus O'Brien as Sardu is really the standout. Mm-hmm. He is the glue that holds this thing together. If he wasn't as good as he is in this film would not work. It would be about another almost 10 years mm-hmm. before we would see a similar villain character that we could have fun with, who would joke with us, who would say, hey, I love being evil and I want to make you watch it. And that's Freddy Krueger. I see Sardu as almost that kind of same archetype, especially when we get into the later films. I mean, it's there in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, but it's definitely there by the time you get to the end of the run.
Oh, yeah. This film is such a product of New York. You know, it is. Yeah. You've got the New York accents, of course, and everything, but it's just such a made by grindhouse filmmakers ready for the grind. You know, it's like they as soon as the film was done being processed, they must have sent it right over to 42nd Street. You know,
they actually shot it right next door to the theater where they show it.
Exactly.
Yeah, it totally is. It has that feel, and that's what's so great about it. And there was a lot of things going on in the 70s in New York that I don't think a lot of people really remember now.
Right.
I mean, the first thing is that you have Tucci, who is the cop who Mr. Maverick calls.
Yeah, Maverick, the football player, boyfriend of the ballerina. I like how it's like they don't even need names. They just might as well have been called ballerina, football player, cop.
They're just symbols.
Right.
They really are. Like if that's kind of what I say about this film is that really all of these are just symbols.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, at one point when Ralphus dances, he plays with symbols. So I don't know. Maybe Joel M. Reed was making sure you got the point that these were symbols.
Not only does he get to play with symbols, but then you get that whole awesome background music going on at the same time, which stops and starts exactly when Ralphus starts his symbols. I love that scene.
Crazy synthesizer music. In New York at the time when this was made in like 75, you know, there was a lot of things going on. And going back to Tucci the cop, he's a corrupt cop and he wants a payoff from Maverick and then eventually he tries to get a payoff from Sardu as well. The film Serpico. Now, we look at that film now, you know, maybe if you don't know New York history, but there was a lot of corruption in New York police in the early 1970s. And that basis of that whole film is on a guy who blew the whistle on the corruption in New York. So you had that going on. Also, remember, this is like 2 years after Watergate.
Right.
So hatred of the government is still, I mean, people really not big on government. The police can be seen as an extension of government.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still kind of that questioning of authority that's still in there. This is not the Disney New York time. As you were saying, this was the grindhouse 42nd Street. This is the real porn-saturated Times Square. This is hell on earth, you know, New York. Right around the time that this film was being made, also, was New York was in a place kind of like where we're at right now in Detroit, where it looks like the city was going to go bankrupt.
Right.
And the mayor went to President Ford and said, look, give me a bailout. Mm-hmm. You know, this was long before the Wall Street bailout. This is long before the GM and Big Three auto bailout. And Ford told him no. And there was all of this sort of stuff going on. There was all this grit. And it's like, I mean, probably for most people who look at New York in the 70s, the one film that kind of echoes, and I think it kind of echoes in this as well, you see it. I mean, I see it in terms of the way the film looks, but also in terms of that grit is Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
To me, Taxi Driver is mid-70s New York, hell on earth New York. This is not Disney New York. This is when Hell's Kitchen was Hell's Kitchen for a reason.
Exactly.
You know, before they decided to change the name. name.
Right. No pretty Tribeca going on here, no.
Yeah.
The world that Travis Bickle was living in, people really think that that's more of the fantasy inside of Robert De Niro's head, and that they don't remember how awful that it really was.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of getting back to, as I said, we wanted to talk about sort of blood-sucking freaks as a possible pro-feminist statement. Mm-hmm. Remember that at the time, this was during the Equal Rights Amendment fight, where you had Betty Ford, the president's wife, saying, we need to have an Equal Rights Amendment. Women mm-hmm. need to be equal in this country. And there was a big fight to try and get that into the Constitution. Never happened. But there was a lot of, you know, you had at the same time, which I think is kind of an offshoot of that, you had the gay rights movement coming in.
Right.
So you had these underclasses that were coming out of the civil rights movement of the 60s that were starting to make themselves known. And not to say that women weren't underclass at the time, but the thing was is that they were starting to make their way into the workplace. They were starting to make their way into society. They were starting to advocate for, you know, why shouldn't I get the same pay as the other guy?
Right. And you can see Sardou as being a complete reaction to that entire thing, you know, just being to a comical end. Like, not only am I going to keep women down, but I'm going to literally keep them down in my basement. I'm going to, you know, torture them and whip them and use them as table furniture and use them as dartboards and just all of this literal objectification of women.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the things, like talking about the wild women in the basement. Mm-hmm. To me, the wild women in the basement, think about it, caged, naked women, caged, raw passion. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is that he's putting these women in the cage, he's keeping them riled up, but not letting them free because mm-hmm. he knows they're dangerous, as he soon finds out in the end. And at the same time, he like pays them off with things. Like the one obvious payoff is in the film, he calls in the doctor to help with the ballerina, Natasha Denali. And, you know, as part of his payment, the doctor gets to torture one of the women, but he goes too far.
Right.
In some, much like, as I said, Hannibal Lecter, you know, he has his limits. You know, it's like there's a certain way of doing things and you cross the line. And so he has Ralphus feed the doctor to the caged women.
Right.
Which, okay, let's look at that. Just look at that as symbolism. Okay, you have caged, passionate women, and you have a doctor. What does the doctor represent? Doctor represents status. Doctor represents professional men. The doctor represents maybe suburban life or all of these things that the patriarchy, Sardou, gives to women to placate them.
Right.
To keep them from busting out of the cage. So there's all of this things like that. And then if you look at the tortures, even in the first few minutes and throughout the entire film, they're all based on things that would be ways of controlling passion mm-hmm. or ways of controlling them in some way. Like there's the thing with the head, you know, there's the brain thing. There's the thing with the brain surgery thing, as we talked about with the doctor.
Which gives us the new title of Bloodsucking Freaks.
Yeah. Yes. And there's the whole thing with the one dancer that he has, and he cuts off her feet. So it's like, I'm the patriarchy. I'm going to remove your passion. I'm going to remove your ways as a woman to express yourself, to be passionate, to all these things. There's one torture where he shocks the woman through her nipples, you know, with electronic shocks. And you could see that as maybe an assault on sex in a woman, passion in a woman, or even motherhood to some extent. So there's all of these things in there. And then in the end of the film, you don't want to give it away, but the whole thing is that the caged women, as I said, you know, get their revenge. Mm-hmm. The women get their revenge in the end. And the ultimate statement of that revenge is the final shot. I'm not going to ruin it for you because I want you to see it. Mm-hmm. But the final shot, to me, put it in when I saw Bloodsucking Freaks, I go, this is a pro-feminist statement. That final shot, you know, there's nothing more of an attack that you could do on a man than that. So,
I think you might have just spoiled it, but whatever.
I didn't spoil it completely.
Right.
But, you know, the thing is that the film sets up this dynamic that women throughout the film, when they're used in particular ways, have value. Mm-hmm. They have value when they're used in these ways, and they're controlled in these ways. He runs a white slave trade where he brings in women. The first scene you see in the film is two guys delivering a crate to Sardou and Ralphus. And it's like, what's in the crate? Well, they open the crate and it's a woman, you know, and he's selling them to other people. The whole thing is that you can see that this whole control of women, and it's like the value in Sardou's world, which you could see as the value that the patriarchy puts on women in the mid 70s. If you want to look at it on that symbolic level, is that you are of value if you do what we want you to do, if we can control your passions, or if we can sell you in some way, if you become a commodity.
Exactly.
And then there's the whole thing with the S&M, where he's, he loves doing the S&M, having people do the S&M for him, because, as I said, he doesn't torture anyone.
Right.
You know, the only thing he comes close to in torturing someone is the dart game,
mm-hmm.
or the backgammon game.
Right.
You know,
which is a great scene.
but there's also this whole thing where it's like he has the thing with the woman who's a dinner table,
mm-hmm.
where he's eating dinner off the woman's back and she's complaining and he's like, "Don't you spoil my dinner?"
Right.
And all this. So there's this whole thing about women as domestic objects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like your proper place is a domestic object. You know, that's what we see you as. And going back to the thing with Ralphus and then the two black women,
mm-hmm.
you can almost make a case that with Sardou, they represent the 50s nuclear family, and that one of the women could be the silent mother who mm-hmm. never stands up
right.
to the horrors that her husband is doing. The other could play the sister, and then Ralphus, of course, is the little brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the son who's being taught by the patriarchal father,
right.
you know, to go out and follow what I do.
Right.
You know, I'm going to show you, my son, at my knee, how mm-hmm. to control
right.
and how to do these things.
Yeah, it's very telling, too, that no matter who was going to play that role, it was going to be a dwarf. So having Ralphus be of color and small in stature was just so telling as far as keeping this person at a level that he wanted to see Ralphus be at, basically.
He didn't have to psychologically do it.
Right.
He just had to literally stand next to him.
Exactly. Yeah. He was always going to be at his knee because that's as tall as he reached. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe his waist.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's just, like I said, I think the film is so much more rich than people give it credit for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those who see it as this notorious movie that has no socially redeeming value, is just misogynistic and anti-woman and horrible, I think they're only watching, like, I would say, just the plain first level, just the visual. But the thing is, it's like, even with that, maybe in 1976 it was disturbing, but compared to Hostel, it's not. It's almost like Hostel is like Bloodsucking Freaks on steroids, but Bloodsucking Freaks is like Mr. Rogers nowadays compared to some of the real torture porn stuff that comes out. And to be honest, I'm not a fan of that stuff.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of the torture genre stuff. I mean, and what's kind of funny, I mean, to say, oh, well, did Eli Roth get his ideas from this movie? I'd say yeah, because he did the commentary on the DVD.
He's obviously a fan.
Yeah. And Joel Reed even talks about that, said that, yeah, he would like follow me around. He was trying to make some documentary on me. So, I mean, obviously Bloodsucking Freaks did play a role in that whole genre of film, whether you like it or not. It's the genesis point. It's where it starts.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, speaking of the interview that we did with Joel M. Reed, let's go ahead and we're going to play that interview back. It's, I think it's pretty darn fun.
How did you get into film and then writing and directing?
Well, I was in the Army, actually. I could have gotten out 3 months earlier, and I applied for different schools. And I met my friend on the subway, and he said, would you like to go out with a couple of actresses tonight? I'm going to their apartment. Actually, we went out on a date, and I said, I think I'll become an actor. So I signed up to the American Academy, which gave me a letter immediately for early discharge from the Army. I don't know if I was really intent on getting in films, but I acted and I got into advertising. I got into commercials. And one day in the 60s, I decided to make a film. And that was with Joe Sarno. I met him and I wrote a script for him called Career Bed. And he said, all we need is $10,000. Go out and get it and make the movie, you know. So I, in my being very naive, went out and got $10,000. And when I called Joe Sarno to come over and direct it, he said, I'm going to Sweden, you direct it. And I said, I haven't the slightest idea how to direct a movie. And he said, well, basically, I do not either. So that's how I got introduced to movie directing. And how Bloodsucking Freaks came about, I had done several movies and I was trying to raise money for them. And this agent, Dorothy Palmer, called me up and said, would you like to see an off-Broadway S&M show, ballet? And I went down to Green Street and I saw Niles Fontaine and his nude girls do sort of S&M dancing. It impressed me. And a group of potential investors that weren't putting up money for my little horror film asked to see Niles' theater piece. When I brought him down, they said, if you make a movie about an off-Broadway theater, you know, with S&M, we'll back it. And I immediately wrote the script that night with a lot of contributions from these potential investors, adding things from their deep desires. And when I finished it, they didn't give me a nickel. And then at the end of the year, this lawyer, Joel Weinberg, called me up and said, can you make a movie right away before January 1st? And I said, yes. And I told him about the script. He said, I don't care about the script. Just make the movie. And I went over to his office and picked up $125,000. So that's how that movie came into being. I mean, in my life, I was in very well mixed up with Broadway and movie society, but I started to make movies just by accident.
Now, Bloodsucking Freaks wasn't the original title. What was the original title? Because I've heard there were several different ones.
Okay, it was called The Incredible Torture Show. Stanley Borden at American Films thought we had a major picture. I was just looking for the ad in the paper. I just discovered it. He bought 100 prints and opened it across the country as a major film. He spent a fortune on it. And we opened at the Cinerama Theater on Broadway. Of course, the film didn't catch on, and I thought it would be better as a midnight show. And Stanley, after the bad opening and not too good reviews, decided to not do anything with it. Years later, somebody introduced me to Tromer. They gave me some money up front, and they didn't do very much, but they put it on 42nd Street. And Bill Landis saw it and wrote this rave review in the East Village Other. And that brought it to life again. And we went into the 8th Street Cinema. And the film caught on to a big audience. We were playing midnight shows. And I think among the celebrities was Michael Pollard. And people like Andy Kaufman were coming to almost every performance. In fact, Andy Kaufman brought his wife one night and she was yelling at him, you stupid motherfucker. Or this is what you do on the weekend, seeing the sick shit. So that's how it began. And then Woman of Pornography got into it and started to pick at us. The film built up a reputation as a midnight show thing. And I think Troma made a lot of money off of it without doing very much.
The story you talked about, you know, you were developing it because these folks had seen this sort of S&M ballet that was sort of off Broadway. As for sort of like the themes or different things that you were trying to write in there, I mean, obviously the Creasy Silo character, who's a theater critic and a dance critic for the paper in town, he's obviously a reference to Clyde Barnes.
Of course, Creasy Silo is actually, if you take translated into English, Creasy was the big battle where Clive won in India. And Silo, of course, is French for Bond, so it's very obvious, you know.
Were you trying to make a satire of sort of like off-Broadway or...
Yes, I was making a satire. I have no interest in S&M. I thought it was very funny, you know. That was the whole idea. It shocked a lot of people, but I was just going, you know, even the William Morris joke, you know, and things like that. It was totally a satire. My humor is very sick. I don't believe in beating up people or young ladies, you know. Now the humor applies. People realize it. But when it opened, I don't think anybody caught the humor, you know, very few people. I only did it. I should have, may have done another script, but there was a check for $125,000 awaiting me. So I went and shot the movie.
Can you sort of share some of the stories on how you met the cast and some of the key people? I mean, kind of starting with Sardou.
Well, actually, I was a signatory to SAG, and I was doing the movie under SAG regulations. And I think John Suki, the president, called me up and he said, we're making this a student film. I said, why? He said, well, we didn't read it, you know. And he said, we don't want to make this an official SAG film account of the content. So you can do it anything you want. But SAG says this is a student film, so we give it, you know, full grace and pleasure to go ahead and shoot it and not pay anybody. But we did pay SAG rates. Most of the agents sent us people in New York, and Seamus O'Brien came from an agent. And he was at that time playing the uncle in The Fantastics and had a long list of credits of Broadway and movies, and he was perfect for the role. Louis D'Aizu was, we had Hervé, the dwarf from Paradise Island, and he was hanging around the office, and he was our first choice. So when we were ready to shoot the movie, he was in France, and we called him in France, and he said, it's hard for little people to get laid in New York, so I went to see my girlfriend in France. So I said, come back. And he said, well, you have to pay half the ticket because he didn't call me. And about exactly that moment, Louis D'Aza walked into the office and we said, what's the difference between one demented dwarf and another? And we hired Louis, you know, but we had at least 800 people come up to open calls on this thing. You know, I was telling the girls, please keep your clothes on. We haven't got the time.
How did you hook up with Hervé? How did you know him?
Oh, Hervé just came. I one of the calls we had enlisted a Screen Actors Guild, and he was one of the probably the only little person that came to our call. I don't think anybody else came. When the first group of investors I started casting with it, and they never put up any money, and that's when I think I met Hervé. He all guaranteed the money, and I never saw a nickel. You know, that was like 2 months before we actually got into production. You know, Hervé didn't have any reputation at the time. So he chose Louis. His son's been calling me, or a little guy that proclaims to be his son. I haven't met with him yet. He looks a lot like Louis.
Speaking of Louis D'Aza, I mean, he went on to a career. Now, was he working in hardcore before?
No, I rolled around. Louis, I don't think had been in any movie, and this was his first movie. And he went on with Bijou into Jerry Damiano and to make a picture called Let My People Come. And he went on to do that. And then he became known as the Anal Dwarf. You know, I saw him occasionally after that. He died of a heart attack not too long after. He died at a very young age. Bijou went on to a short career in porn, and then she got involved in drugs and spent time in jail in Mexico and up here. And then the FBI was looking for her, and I had a hide out to keep her from coming over to the apartment because I didn't want to deal with her anymore.
I heard that Seamus O'Brien also ended up meeting sort of a tragic end not soon after the film was completed.
Yes, she was murdered right after the movie was done, and there were several stories. I was at his wake. Somebody said that he caught a burglar in his apartment. Somebody else said that it was a black guy sitting on the stoop in the East Village, and he asked him to move, and a black guy stabbed him. And somebody else said he picked up a black guy and brought him home, which I don't know. You know, Seamus had a bunch of children and stuff. In essence, he was stabbed to death one night in his apartment or on the front steps of his apartment. He was a very wonderful guy. I mean, he and Louis were working together and working out the scenes, and Seamus was helping Louis so much, you know. Seamus had a long, long list of credits of an actor.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask is, you know, what was sort of the day-to-day like on the set? Sort of take me through it. How long was the shoot, and when did you guys shoot? Kind of thing like that.
Well, we shot many hours. I think we shot 10 days, but we shot, like, without sleeping. And it was a very wonderful, everybody was happy with each other. We had plenty of food, and it was a lot of fun. You know, everybody was great except Bijou, who never learned the lines correctly. And always had somebody picking her up who wanted to leave after an hour. But we had no problems. We had one girl in the cage who walked off her set. She was walking around totally naked, but her boyfriend was interfering with everything. And I told her to get him out of there. So they both left. Outside of that, there were no problems at all. You know, everybody was wonderful. In fact, one of the girls in the movie, my friend applied for a job, I don't know, at Reader's Digest International in Boston, and he walked into the vice president's office, and he saw a poster of Bloodsucking Freaks on the wall, and he asked the girl interviewing him why she had the poster, and she said she was in the movie, and she was proud of it. She's one of the girls, backgammon girls, I think. And somebody said one of the girls in the cage went on to stardom. I'm not sure who. I still hear from some of the people in the movie. Got to realize they're senior citizens now.
There's a lot of rumors related to the film, and there was one that I wanted to kind of check by you and see if this was, you know, bullshit or not. And one was that Louis D'Aza had orchestrated an orgy on the set on the last day.
No, there was a party up at a script girl's place who was very rich. He had a duplex apartment. And downstairs, it was rather conservative. Upstairs in the bedroom, there was actually an orgy going on. Everybody was doing coke. And I guess it's okay to say that they're both dead. And Bijou came in with a guy, she said it was Rod Stewart, but I think he was a phony. And they were getting married. And we had a drink. And she said, what's going upstairs? I said, everybody's doing coke and getting drunk. She said, I want to go. I said, no, it's pretty wild up here. I walked her upstairs and everybody said, take your clothes off, Bijou, you can't stay. And she did. She took her clothes off. She started giving me head. And then I looked down, she disappeared. And there she was in the middle of the floor being f***ed by Louis, who had a quite a big dick for his size. And that's quite a wild party upstairs. I promised to f*** one of the girls on the movie. And like 9 o'clock the next morning, I was half dead and I had to disappoint her, you know. But that was a really great party, you know, for those times. I mean, Vija was far from being a virgin, but then they went on to make porn together. I saw her with about 8 guys on top of her, you know. But she was a real weirdo. I try to avoid having any close relationships with her, but I was so stoned at the party, you know.
The actual look of Bloodsucking Freaks is pretty gritty, and the colors are kind of muted, and it came out around like the same time as Taxi Driver, you know, that sort of same era in New York. And I was wondering if that was your idea to make it look kind of like that, or if you just, it was just kind of the film that was around at the time that it made it look kind of muted and really kind of gritty.
I think because Troma is too cheap to get a new print, but the original prints were very good. Ron Dorfman, who I don't know what happened to it, shot it, you know, and it looked very good. It was shot in 16 millimeter and blown up to 35. It was actually too Hollywoodish. It's grainy now. It's accounted the thing they're releasing, you know, because I have a brand new print of it and it looks gorgeous. We try to make it look as best as possible. We shot with an Aeroflex 16 and then we blew it up to 35 millimeter.
You talked about the original release of the film. It didn't really go over the first time and then it kind of came back under a different title. Talk about what the audience was like. I mean, how did they react when this movie first came out?
Some of the people walked out. I think it was playing in major large theaters and it was completely wrong, you know. We intended to be a midnight show in the beginning. I had seen guys walk out. But when it started playing midnight, you know, people picked up on it. You know, once in a while, you get the odd girl that would walk out on it. And as the years passed by, people got more and more of the humor. I don't know where Women Against Pornography, I think Troma called them up. We would have played forever at the ACB Playhouse. I know it played 56 weeks by Harvard. I think it was a film before its time. Somebody's just looking at it, you know. It wouldn't shake up anybody. It was the little guy that did Hostel, you know, Eli Roth. He was hanging around here for years. He was one of my fans. I think he follows my school, you know, but his films are much more disgusting than mine, graphically. I intended the whole thing as a joke. Now I look back at it, and I should have started a serious artistic venture, which would give me a reputation as an auteur. But now I'm gaining that reputation.
When Michael Herz and Lloyd Kaufman of Troma picked up Bloodsucking Freaks, they were just kind of starting out. Do you remember sort of your interactions with them?
Yes, I was very friendly with them. Nobody wanted to film. They gave me money up front. We made a deal with Vestron Video, which I got half of, was a big check. And I never heard from them again. And then my partner sold them the rights to the film without, basically, he shouldn't have. Now they call me up every once in a while to do a, you know, a director's thing, and I won't do it. You know, they offered me $500. They supposedly paid Eli Roth $35 to put the DVD together, you know, and I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in getting on and working on some new projects. But right now, they don't talk to me. I don't know what their situation is, and I'm very happy not to talk to them.
One of the things that was something that Lloyd, I think, told me when I talked to him before, and I wanted to see if this was another myth related to Bloodsucking Freaks or not, was that he said that he possibly had hired, I think he told me he had hired protesters to protest the film to, like, gin up controversy.
He called the people from Women Against Pornography, and the problem was that is the landlord of the A Street Theater, they had a clause of no pornography in their lease. So they tried to evict the guy that ran the theater. So he had to stop the film playing there. I don't think they hired him. I think they just called up.
Because he made it sound like he had hired people to protest it, and then the real protesters showed up. Not that he had called the pornography people.
The real protester did show up, and they stopped playing the film at the A Street. So I think he contributed to that. That story is true, yes.
One of the things that's interesting about it, and I mean, I understand the times in that way that, I mean, this came out in the middle of like Women's Lib and all of that stuff. I remember when I first saw Bloodsucking Freaks the first time, I saw it as the satire, as we talked about, but I also saw it as you were putting, and I think you were putting things in the film, and this is something I wanted to ask you about, from my estimation, is actually kind of pro-feminist, because in the end, the people who are oppressing the women pay in the end.
A lot of women have seen the film and asked me to make a sequel, which the women dominate the men, you know, totally. I wrote a script, actually, when I first wrote this, which is Bloodsucker Creeks Part 2, where the villain is a 14-year-old girl who gets her kicks out of beating up on men. It's very funny. It's much more humorous. You know, it's just something done in a hurry. You know, if you would afterthought, you know, but I thought it was funny. I enjoyed doing it. People enjoyed working on it. And women like it much better now. Back in those days, the women found it very messy. You know, whatever, it was a woman-hating film. But I just do those things to make money. I did it because there was money there, you know.
It's been like 35 years. Since it first came out, and I was just wondering, you know, how maybe your thoughts have changed on Bloodsucking Freaks over that time. You look back on it today, are your thoughts different on the movie?
Oh, if I went back on it, no, I don't think I would make it less apologetic. There's not much you can do to it. When I think about it, I think I should have put more humor into it. It's really no, I think that's what it is, you know. I think that it's been surpassed in violence and cruelty. I have projects, but not with that much S&M.
Speaking of things that are a little more sadistic, and you kind of talked about it a little bit, like Hostel and Saw and the so-called, you know, torture porn genre, you know, that seems to have happened over the last 10 years or so. I mean, to me, I look at those and they kind of seem like ginned up versions of Bloodsucking Freaks, but I think Bloodsucking Freaks really has more humor. It's lighter in tone.
I'm basically a humorist and I have a lot of followers. People send me films that they made or they're going to make. And they're very vicious. You see all of Eli Roth stuff. I'm sure you did. And he was a fan of mine. He was hanging around in the apartment. I don't know where he got the muscles from. He was shooting a documentary about me and following me on the subway. And his stuff, to me, is very vicious. You know, mine was humorous. That's the difference.
You know, you go, you do these screenings, you meet people who are fans of the film. Are you amazed that, you know, 35 years on or so, people are still interested? And what do you think is maybe the common thing that ties together people who like this movie?
I don't know. I think, obviously, humor. I had a thing this winter at this theater in Brooklyn. Actually, the only people who came was from a Jewish religious school. All these kids that had to come with their parents. Oh, well, a lot of my fans are 11 years old. They're goths, you know. And here is all these kids that couldn't go by themselves. I think the oldest was 14, and they're fans of the film. I guess in the spring, I got a call from Sag Harbor, New York, and this girl sounded very interesting. And I'm very careful because I have a lot of young fans, but, you know, and she sounded much like an adult. So I arranged to meet her at the cafe, pick me up on Avenue Way in the village, you know, and when I walked in, I saw her. I knew who she was right away. And I said, I hope your mother's with her. She was 11 years old. Her mother was there.
Do you advise that 11 and 12-year-olds should watch Bloodsucking Freaks?
That's right. Yes. One of my fans came over and she was just starting high school. She had half her head shaved off, you know, just hair on one side. She was 12, I think. She had a tat. She had piercings and a lip and I said, well, are you in high school yet? She said, no, I started in the fall. I said, you got to straighten out your act. She said, no, I'm going just like I look now. The other students. So those are my fans. That's the bulk of my fans. I have a lot of people that know every line in the picture. Incidentally, Dan Fossey, the cop in the movie, went on to be the head of 20th Century Fox, you know, and he had a memo out. If anybody mentions that movie, I'll fire them. And actually, his daughter wanted to, supposed to get together with her. She's producing movies out on the coast, and she said, I'm going to talk to my father. But I never heard from her again. So I hope to do another movie, you know, if they're not too old, you know.
Where should folks go if they want to keep up with you, if they want to see what projects you're working on and your past work?
I have a joelemreid.net website, and then I'm on Facebook. I have one parting thought. I did a show out in Los Angeles at the Palace Theater, and I was signing autographs, and this couple came with this little kid. They were holding him by the hand, you know, and they said, can we take a picture with you? And I said, sure, and I got over and put my arms around. No, they said, with my son. I said, what do you want a picture with my son, your son, for? She said, we don't like your movie. He has to watch it every night before he goes to bed. I said, how old is he? She said, 2.5. So there are a lot sicker people in the world than me, or maybe I'll grow up to be a priest or a rabbi or something. Who knows? Thank you, God.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
So that was a very fun time talking to Mr. Reed. He definitely has his stories down. A few weeks ago, Rob sent me a couple of YouTube clips of Joel introducing the film, talking about the film. And it's funny, his stories are pretty much identical to those clips.
And he made almost the exact same mistakes.
Exactly.
Instead of saying Fantasy Island, it was Paradise Island. And yeah. Let My People Come, as opposed to the Jerry Damiano film, the guy who did Deep Throat,
right.
Let My Puppets Come. I don't know. I mean, Let My People Come almost sounds like if it was Moses.
Right, right.
You know, sort of like freeing the Israelites in Egypt in a very sexy way.
Right. As I mentioned before, I said that no matter who was going to play Ralph is, it was going to be a person of smaller stature. I can't imagine what this film would have been like had Hervé Villechaize played Ralphus.
It just would have been amazing. I think that, you know, Hervé, I mean, everyone knows him now,
right.
You know, obviously. I mean, he's gone, he's passed on, but he was such an iconic person when he was around. I mean, he captivated people in a way, you know, that I think really no small stature person had since maybe The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Or Billy Barty.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Billy Barty, probably the most popular dwarf. I believe that the guy who is in the Pirates of the Caribbean movie might be kind of catching up on Billy Barty's territory. I'm having a hard time picturing him as Ralphus because Louis DeJesus captures that role so perfectly. He is so awesome in that. I mean, he just, the dancing around and just being so happy all the time.
I almost think that Harvey would have been a little dark.
Yeah.
I think he would have been a little more sinister.
Right, right.
Well, Ralphus is sort of like a jester.
Yeah,
you know, he's
definitely
like this kind of clown. He's just laughing his head off throughout this entire thing. He's just having fun. It's just amazing to watch him. I mean, they just kind of wound him up and let him go. It's crazy. I haven't had a chance to track down the Damiano film, Let My Puppets Come, because I haven't seen him in that. But I have to say, the anal dwarf? Man, what a title.
Yeah.
This was before Bloodsucking Freaks, I guess. It was a loop. It was only like, I don't know, 10 minutes in Super 8 or something. But it was a notorious loop, I guess. And that's where Joel Reed said he first met him. He knew the film. So I guess if you hung around.
I've seen your work before. Very impressive.
Brilliant.
Even though he didn't have it, I picture Joel M. Reed with a big cigar in his hand all the time.
That was great.
But some of the people who are in it, the one who plays the ballerina, Natasha de Natalie, Viju Krim. Oh,
wow.
Joel Reed talks about her in the interview and just how, like, kind of...
Not a rocket surgeon.
No.
Yeah, that her performance is just amazing. I had forgotten how bad it was. And really, throughout most of the movie, I'm just like, okay, you know, I'm watching this, I'm just like, whatever, she's not that good and stuff, but it's not painful until you get to a run of dialogue.
I'm sorry I didn't call you, Tom, but I've just been so tied up with my new show.
Well, you're here willingly?
Oh, of course. I mean, Lincoln Center, it is just so boring. You know, one Giselle after the other, that would be the only thing that I would have to look forward to. Believe me, Sardou is a genius. This is where it's all at, right here in Soho.
I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but that's pretty amazing. And then, like Seamus O'Brien.
Oh, yeah.
What a loss. I mean, I think he could have been just an amazing character actor. It would have been nice to see him in other things. I know that Joel M. Reed said he has like a bit part in maybe Marathon Man or something.
Mm-hmm.
Real small, like maybe one, two line kind of stuff. Did a few other things, but he was mostly like...
Should have played the Laurence Olivier role in that. Is it safe?
The dentist, yes. The crazy dentist.
Him and Ralph is making an appearance again.
But that's what's so good is that he is just... I think he nails it. No way. I'm like, it's just perfect.
Yep.
You know? And he like, I don't know if he had that accent because I think he may have been from Ireland or England or something, but he just has this accent and he has this like presence about him that he, like I said, like low rent Hannibal Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a certain way of doing things. He's proper. He's a gentleman in that way. You know, it's like he's not getting his hands dirty.
Right.
He's going to have everyone else do his bidding for him.
You know that even when he's having dinner on that woman's back, he's probably got the salad fork, dinner fork.
He knows which utensil goes
exactly.
Where on that setup
exactly.
On the plate.
He could have dinner with the queen or on the back of a woman slave, yes.
But some of the other people who are in it, I guess the guy who played Tucci.
Mm-hmm.
He went on to be an executive at 20th Century Fox, as Joel M. Reed tells us. And then the guy who played Creasy Silo, I can't remember his name, but he was in, I first saw him in the opening scene of Putney Swope,
right.
Robert Downey Sr.'s, I think, probably masterpiece film from the late 60s. And that's where I first heard him. And it was more like I heard his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw Bloodsucking Freaks, I was like, oh, it's the same guy. But I can't remember his name. But he was just, you know, a great... great actor as well. I mean, because if you're going to play in those scenes against Seamus O'Brien as Sardou, you have to bring it.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and he does this awesome job bringing it. So I've got a lot of respect for that actor. He just does an awesome job.
Be sure to keep up with Rob St. Mary over at WDET. Listen to him live on the air or via the archives. As I said, I've got that bookmark. You should too. Thanks for listening, folks. Be sure to check out more of the episodes of The Projection Booth over at iTunes, via Stitcher, or even on Jackalope Radio. So we're going to head out this week with a rather astounding rap about Bloodsucking Freaks that I found called Vaudeville Godkill, and I know I'm going to Godkill these names, by Roughneck Jihad and Maestro, it's either Gamin or Gamin, Gamite, I'm not sure what it is, but regardless, it is a very fun little song that hopefully folks will enjoy.
Welcome to the show, I'll be your co-host, folks. If I could ask you to lean close, I'll play out the pain like a maestro. Slow, building up the tempo. You see, MCs are weak, so tonight's a real treat. We got trash on the beat, Jahan spit like chains and whips with wit and mystique. Strap you in your seat, this show ain't for the meek. If you run for the billfold, trade in your mic for a steel pole. I guess these girls gotta eat, we'll treat you like group freaks, nymphos. First I'm gonna need a new victim out the front row. No, I mean volunteer, commandeer your girl in the big brassiere and flash the veneers. I smell fear and loathing before I rock the mic with a cold sneer. I'm slow encroaching, removing your clothing. Hold back your tears, no moping. Remember, this is your career. Lights, camera, close up with glamour. Scream from the rapture and cheer. It ain't all smoke and mirrors when you're choking. Deep throat squirm like a loach, abandon all hope. Raffles on standby, stroking with a cowboy hat and a rope. Get low till you're broke, your stains leave you soaked. Stank, rank, skeet all up in your flanks till I'm drained. Draw blank, you like finger paint, play it off like a prank. Pain is easy. Sipping my drink, tear streaks look sleazy. Cuts in your lower back, acting real she. Smearing the feces, surreal like Fellini. This is the real shit, we sick like Comini. Teasing your bits till they're bleeding. Bust on your knees at these styles, I'm seedy. Ralph is dancing around freaky.
Aleister Crowley, make them all dance. The haka like a Maori, dope like cocaine, white like a howley. Wild like Europeans down in a Bowery. Flip flipper from mousy to mouthy, the pay is lousy.